So this is the last of four talks about what Bhante describes as one spiritual experience, which has different aspects to it, of which the most important is, the most central one, is going for refuge to the three jewels. And in the first talk, we looked at going for refuge itself. We explored how to deepen our motivation and our inspiration for practice. We looked at the whole volitional aspect. And we also looked at the importance of focusing on our potential. In a way, it doesn't matter where we start from. However useless and so on we think we might be, we can transform ourselves. The Dharma is extraordinary. And our potential is extraordinary. Then in the second talk, we looked at insight and stream entry. And we explored the importance of focusing on the nature of experience rather than the content. And looking at our direct experience rather than our stories and ideas and interpretations of it. And then last week, we looked at altruism, at love and compassion, and the arising of the bodhicitta. We explored the importance of focusing on others rather than just on ourselves. And we looked at empathy. Remember in Shakespeare's Tempest, at the beginning, after there's been a shipwreck, Miranda says, "I have suffered with those I saw suffer." She can put herself in their very wet shoes. And we also looked at a whole lot of ways of working with overwhelm. That sense, which we can have all too easily these days, when we contemplate the suffering in the world, of being caught like a rabbit in the headlights, that it's just too much. I think I mentioned 12 different things that you could do about overwhelm. And the insight dimension and the compassion dimension kind of go together. The more you see into the nature of things, the less you take your experience as real, the less you get caught up in it, the easier it is to respond with compassion. Because you're not so focused on a sense of me in the middle of it, you're not focusing on taking it all as substantial and taking it as given. So that gives you a lightness and a freedom and a capacity to sort of move in response. And in all our three talks so far, as well as looking at aspects of Dharma practice, there's also been an undercurrent of imagery connected with the Pacific Ocean, and especially with the Polynesian wayfinders or navigators, who make journeys of thousands of miles across the Pacific. And they do this without using a compass or a sextant or any other instruments, just using an intimate knowledge. Well, an intimate knowledge of and a sensitivity to all the conditions under which they find themselves. The sun, the moon, the stars, the wind, the rain, the storms, the ocean currents, all that they see in terms of the fish and the seabirds and so on. Out of all this information, they can track their journey over thousands of miles. So continuing our ocean metaphor, at the risk of making you all seasick by week four, the title of this fourth talk comes from a poem by Walt Whitman, So the title of the talk is Steering for the Deep. And there's a part of a poem called Passage to India where he says, passage, immediate passage, the blood burns in my veins. Away, O soul, hoist instantly the anchor, cut the hawsers, haul out, shake out every sail. Have we not stood here like trees in the ground long enough? Have we not grovelled here long enough, eating and drinking like mere brutes? Have we not darkened and dazed ourselves with books long enough? Sail forth, steer for the deep waters only. So, this evening we're going to steer for the deep waters only. And he goes on to say, for we are bound where mariner has not yet dared to go, and we will risk the ship, ourselves, and all. So, be prepared. So what does it mean to steer for the deep waters only? So in this talk we're going to focus on the deep waters of the depth dimension of this moment of our experience, and on the aspect of going for refuge that involves opening to deeper levels of mind, deeper levels of awareness, and opening to the deep inner resources which we all have. So steering for the deep waters suggests to me a change in how we see what we're trying to do as Dharma practitioners. I think it involves exploring what I like to call the depth dimension of the present moment. And this is a way of looking at things that balances out our mind's tendency to be constantly trying to get somewhere else. Never satisfied. Now I know that going for refuge is often portrayed as following a path, going on a journey, going on a voyage even. But from the highest perspective, the whole image of the journey is misconceived, as inevitably it involves aversion to what's happening now and craving for something else. And it also tends to perpetuate the idea that there's a me that's going through all this journey, a self that is going to arrive at enlightenment at the end of it. So, sure, we need to look at things in terms of trying to get somewhere. We need to inspire and motivate ourselves by recalling our situation and where we want to get to in our Dharma life. But then most of getting there, so to speak, involves engaging deeply with what's going on now. Getting beneath our superficial attractions and repulsions and our habitual tendencies. Looking deeply at what's really going on now. And turning towards each moment with as much love and care as we can find. And if we really give ourselves fully to this moment, this present moment in this way, we shall find ourselves, when we, as it were, look up to see how we're doing, moving along the path. And this can be a quite a big shift of perspective in everyday life. I think it's fair to say most people spend most of their time leaping out of the present moment into the past or into the future. And the idea that enlightenment, that awakening, is to be found in the present moment, waiting to be discovered, can feel quite radical. It takes a shift of perspective. It's a bit like the shift of perspective that the Polynesian wayfinders had in the way that they looked at their whole situation. As far as they were concerned, the boat didn't move. The boat stayed still. It was just directed in a particular direction, and the islands came out of the sea to meet the boat. That was how they saw it. It's completely the reverse of how we would tend to imagine it. So going deeper into the present moment is a bit like that. In a sense, we're not trying to get anywhere. We're just trying to be really completely, deeply here. And when we do that, we go into what I'm calling this depth dimension, which is a deeper level of awareness. It's an exploration of deeper levels of mind. And this idea of deeper levels of mind is most clearly spelt out by the Yogacara school of Mahayana Buddhism. Yogacara is focused on mind and how it functions. In fact, its key understanding is that everything is mind, that everything is experience, that all we know, whether it's what we think of as in here or out there, is always our experience. It's always an experience of mind. And this can be really empowering, because when we realize this, we see that we have far more influence than we thought. We aren't the passive recipients of whatever we happen to get from the external world. Our minds are active interpreters. In a sense, they're even active creators of the worlds we live in moment by moment. So by becoming more aware of the process by which we fabricate, by which we create worlds for ourselves, we can learn to create worlds without suffering. And when we do this, it's not that, you know, the world is really tough, but we manage to create some fairy tale which makes it all right by telling ourselves something which isn't true. The truth is much more wonderful than that. The truth is far more amazing than that. We can discover that the suffering is an add-on. It's something that we are creating through how we're using our minds. So when we don't use our minds in that way, there is no suffering. Suffering is not inherent. It's something that we're producing through not understanding how things are and using our minds in ways that just don't work very well. That's the suffering. And we can stop doing that and become happy and free. That's what the Buddha saw, and so can we. And we create this suffering, according to Yogacara, by interpreting our experience in terms of me in here, and a separate external world out there. And Yogacara explains how we do this in terms of eight aspects of awareness. Talks about the eight vijnanas. Vijnana means something like consciousness, although as we'll see, this doesn't work fantastically as a translation. So what are these eight consciousnesses? So the first five are just what we are, sense, everyday sense consciousnesses. So we're seeing, we're hearing, we're smelling, we're tasting, we're touching. And then the sixth consciousness, which is aware of all the mental aspect of our experience. So the emotions, the moods, the ideas, the images, all that. And I find it really interesting that that's just regarded as kind of a sixth consciousness. It's on the same level as the other five. We tend to really prioritize, you know, thinking and those aspects of things. Whereas for Yogacara, yes, it's just another sphere of experience, just like all those others. So we have those five everyday sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. And then Yogacara perceives two further aspects of cognition, of knowing, aspects of mind. Firstly, there's a functioning of mind which is interpreting our experience all the time. Interpreting it in terms of me and here and the world out there. Interpreting in terms of subject and object. And Yogacara regards this as the cause of our difficulties. So it calls this the defiled mind, the defiled consciousness. It's the consciousness which has lost track of how things really are. It's lost track of the nature of things. And then there's also a deeper, what feels like a more inward level of experience, which is called the alaya, which means something like the storing awareness, the storing aspect of mind. We'll look at this in a minute. So consciousness actually isn't a very good word for vijnana, because it sometimes refers to aspects of experience of which we're not very conscious at all. For example, most of what happens on this alaya level of functioning, we don't have any direct kind of conscious access to. And also, we don't want to think of these eight vijnanas, these eight consciousnesses in inverted commas, as separate things. There's just a complete flow of awareness. Or, let's say something like a rainbow, where you can kind of distinguish the yellow from the green, but you can't really say where one finishes and the next one starts. They kind of shade into one another. It's all just part of one experience. There are no neat lines in mind. It's not like that. It's not that kind of a thing. In fact, it's not a thing at all. The Buddha recognized that everything in mind is in dynamic relationship to everything else. And mind, in a way, is just the word for the sum total of all these processes interacting. So this eight consciousness analysis isn't meant to divide things up. It's just a way of looking at things which can be helpful. So we mustn't make the mistake of treating them as eight parts of a thing called mind. Just see the whole thing as dynamic. Yeah, see yourself as dynamic, because that's how we are. And this eighth consciousness, in inverted commas, this alia, this deepest level of mind, one of its functions is that it stores, or it expresses the effects of our volitional actions continuing forward. So like in each moment as we're sitting here, it's not like we're completely still and at rest and each moment is just appearing as it is. It's as if we're coming at each moment with a sort of a momentum, a kind of velocity. We're coming at it from an angle. Yeah. We're approaching this moment, yeah, from a certain direction. And that momentum, that velocity, that vector, that direction, is the result of all the kind of volitional actions of body, speech and mind from the past. Yeah. So it's a bit like there's a kind of wave that's kind of carrying us along. And so we're carried into this moment, and that causes us to interpret the experience of this moment in a particular way. And this introduction of the idea of this alia, this deep storing consciousness, represents a kind of shift in how Buddhist meditation worked. Early Buddhism tends to kind of try to sort of freeze frame, if you see what I mean. It wants to just look at this thought moment, and what's going on here in this thought moment. Is there craving present, for instance? Yeah. So we just look at this thought moment, and it got sliced down into, you know, thought instants of very, very fine moments. And that was a useful way of exploring what was going on. In the second talk about insight, I said, you know, it could be very useful just to look at, you know, the sort of bare experience, or as bare as we can get it, of this present moment. However, that's very useful, but it's not enough for practice. What Yogacara says is that we need not only to examine in terms of moments, kind of hitting the pause button, to explore what's going on right now, but we also need to have a sense of continuity, of flow. Otherwise, for instance, we won't see karma, we won't see how actions have consequences, because you can only see that when you get a sense of flow. Yeah? You only see that when you get that sense of moving through time. Also, this idea that, you know, you can, as it were, kind of chop mind down very, very fine, just looking at one thing at a time, can lead to a kind of staccato, sort of fragmented view of things. Yogacara reckoned that each moment is very rich. There are a lot of functions going on. There's a lot happening. And all these are part of a unity that we call mind. So Yogacara, as well as having this analysis of different functions of mind, different levels almost of functioning of mind and awareness, also talks in terms of what it calls, well, in the translation that Bhante uses, which comes from D.T. Suzuki, it talks about turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. And this is another of the terms from different Buddhist traditions that Bhante is kind of linked together when talking about this one spiritual experience which we can unfold in our Dharma lives. And the traditional term for this turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness is ashraya paravritti. Ashraya literally means something like a root or a foundation. So it's a turning about at the foundation, a turning about right at the basis of awareness. And this turning about is described at different levels of practice. It's referred to as the moment when the bodhisattva penetrates the path of insight, when subject and object fall away, when there's an experience without that subject-object duality, which makes it really clear that the subject-object duality is something we're adding on to our experience. And the turning about is also talked about right at the end of the path as the complete transformation of mind, which comes out of the Dharma-like samadhi, the Dharma-like concentration. So we could look at this turning about in terms of Bhante's analysis, in terms of effective turning about, real turning about, and ultimate turning about. So effective turning about, or turning around, would be when we actually start looking at mind and its responses and reactions, rather than being just caught up in the contents of experience. When we start to notice much more that our experience is our experience, that it's all an experience of mind. And part of the practice would be exploring our awareness and making conscious the deeper kind of currents that are pulling on us, the making conscious that momentum, that velocity which we bring into each moment, gradually resolving it, gradually dissolving what's unhelpful and unskillful in it. And if we do that, then one day we get to the real turning around. The moment at which there's an experience which isn't in terms of subject and object. And that moment is a deep coming home to life. There's just experience, but there's no one experiencing it as an object. Which means that there's no sense of separation, isolation, and so on. So, the practice leading up to this point is gradual, it's just working away with our minds. More and more, working with the precepts, working to unfold more and more skillful aspects of mind. But this turning about, this real turning about, happens all at once. It changes everything. So in a way you have a gradual process leading to a sudden change in how mind is functioning. After it, you may fall back into old thought patterns. But the experience itself in the moment is complete. We are complete, so to speak. Everything is complete. Because there is no division. There is no separation. And that sense of interpreting in terms of a subject-object is seen through. There's no more mistaking. What we tend to do is we mistake this alia, this deep level of awareness, this deep level of mind, for a self. And then we take most of our sensory perception as other. So we have effective turning about, real turning about, and then there's an ultimate turning about, which is the final release from any tendency to experience in a dualistic way. We don't even have a single moment where we feel cut off from life. There isn't the tiniest hairbreadth of separation between us and life. We're totally at home in all experience. In fact, we're totally at home because that sense of me and experience has disappeared. And at this point, the eight consciousnesses become the five wisdoms, the five aspects of timeless awareness, as they're sometimes called. There's just an aware, spontaneous, positive flow of experience with no self-reference and not the slightest alienation from anything. And this is symbolized by the five wisdoms of the five Buddhas, or the five Buddhas embody these five wisdoms. So that was all the theory. Well, it's certainly, there's loads of theory, but it's certainly plenty for one talk, and it's certainly all I'm going to give you this evening. So how do we move in the direction of that turning about? How do we help to set up the conditions for it to happen? So first off, it does help to recognize that everything is experience. That all our experience, moment by moment, is our experience. That all that's happening now, this theatre, is a kind of magic theatre. It's a theatre of mind. That's what we're experiencing. Never mind whether there's any objective something or other out there made of brick and wood and so on. What we're experiencing right now is the magic theatre of mind. Here we are in it. And that gives us, once we get a feeling for that, it gives us a whole different relation to it. And it gives us a different relation to other people as well, because actually other people aren't other people, are they? Because they're all experiences within awareness. So there's nothing that's alien to us. There's nothing that's foreign. There's nothing that's nothing to do with us, because it's all our experience. It's all appearing within awareness. So working with that, that helps. And then secondly, seeing, recognizing that how we interpret and respond to that experience is crucial. That we do have tremendous power. We're not unhappy and suffering because of what is going on. Finally, we're suffering because of how we're interpreting it and how we're relating to it and how we're therefore reacting on the basis of that. Which unfortunately puts the responsibility fully on our shoulders, which is the last place we want it. But once we get used to that, it's actually really liberating, because it means, you know, we can then put down that burden if we want. Whereas if it's all out there and there's nothing we can do about it, then we're stuck. So, yeah, we can be aware that we're creating, wherever we're suffering, somehow we're doing that through how we're creating this interpretation of our experience now. So we can change that, look at that. thirdly, it helps if we recognize that there are depths of mind, depths to mind, that we can't very often experience directly, but that influence us. And we can get feelings of this, you know, it's like, you know, moods come upon us that, or, you know, we have dreams that really affect us. All kinds of ways. It's as if we're not just, you know, a thin sort of thread of awareness, you know, carrying along. We can have a sense, often quite easily, particularly if we meditate and we start to tune in, that there are kind of, you know, there's a lot of deep water, you know, down below the boat of everyday awareness, and there's all sorts of things happening in that deep water. And we can influence what happens on those deeper levels. We may not be able to experience it directly very often, but we can influence those deeper currents, let's call them, by how we act, by our skillful actions of body, speech, and mind. And as long as we're still on this dualistic level, we'll have to keep making the effort to do that. Day after day, week after week, year after year. Yeah. Just putting those, you know, like sort of, yeah, sort of tossing seeds into the ocean, if that's not a weird image. Yeah, just, well, Bhante's image is of depth charging, which I think is worse, so we'll stick to that. Yeah, or feeding the fish, whatever, feeding the positive fish, putting those positive actions into effect, and you can wonder why in some forms of Buddhism they do things over and over and over again. You know, you do 100,000 of Vajrasattva mantras or whatever, but it's just trying, as it were, to influence those sort of deeper levels of mind, to keep on repeatedly, you know, doing what's helpful, doing what will transform those deeper levels. And we can also use some of those practices involve using symbols or mantra, all these more things which are on more of a sort of archetypal level, because they're ways of connecting with and communicating with those deeper levels. So it's worth imagining the Buddha, it's worth imagining bodhisattvas, it's worth doing mantra, it's worth operating in all these ways. Yeah. And sometimes it does feel like, was it casting bread on the waters? That's biblical, isn't it? I can't remember. Yeah, we do these things and we may not immediately notice any great change. It's not like you get a sort of immediate positive feedback from doing them. But we just have to trust the process. To trust the process of that if we put, as it were, good, helpful, skillful energy actions into the mind, that will have an effect, even if we don't see it to start with. There's that well-known poem by Juan Ramon Jimenez, the Spanish poet, it's translated by Robert Bly, which goes, "I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing." And nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens? Or has everything happened? And are we standing now, quietly, in the new life? Yeah, so sometimes we put that energy into practice and we just have to trust. We have to have confidence that the effects of our practice are never wasted, that Alia is storing all the effects of our practice, and that over time those positive effects will manifest in our conscious everyday life. And we can also help along this whole process by the practice of what Bhante calls just sitting. If just sitting goes deep, it becomes what some texts call resting in the alaya, resting in this deep level of awareness. So how would that happen? What would that be like? Well, essentially what we'd do would be we'd sit, preferably having built up a degree of absorption, having stilled the mind to some degree, and then our experience of the five senses is going on. There are feelings in the body, there are sounds, if our eyes are open there are sights, smells, taste. But we don't put any energy into them. We don't invest in any of those at all. We just let them be there. So that allows mind to relax. So there's a letting go. There's a letting go of the sounds, a letting go of the sights, a letting go of the feelings in the body. No holding on. Just letting them go. And then similarly, we do that even with images in the mind, thoughts, whatever's there. We just let them come and go. And if we don't hold on to them, they will. That's what they do. So if we do that, letting go, letting go, letting go, there comes a point where it's as if we relax more into deeper levels of mind. And then we come even more to that sort of more emotional level, which is caught up with judging and organizing things into subject-object. And we just let go. We just let go of our mood. We let go of the emotions. We let go of even needing to see things in any particular way. Letting go, letting go, letting go. Until finally, there's just this deep resting. Deep resting. And it's so healing for mind to do that. Just not to get caught up. So we can practice in this way. Yeah? It's a matter of how far we get, you know, whether we manage to rest right in the alaya or not. Just that, getting that sense of relaxing, letting mind relax, getting used to letting go, not investing. Brings us down eventually to that level where there won't be any concepts, there won't be any kind of mental movements, much. There aren't any thought processes in the usual sense of the term. It's not like there's kind of connected thinking going on. That connected thinking requires us to be holding on to some degree, requires us to be invested. If we don't do that, then that level sort of drops away. But it's not like we don't know anything, but the knowing is much quicker, much more direct, much more intuitive. So, we just rest as stably as we can, in a state, ideally, of clarity with no concepts. We're not pursuing sense impressions, we're not pursuing emotions or thoughts. And if you're familiar with the six element practice, with that meditation, you'll see that, in a way, that's trying to take you to in the same direction. Yeah. It's trying to, really, fundamentally what it's about is this deep letting go. It's the sixth element practice just uses a different way in. But that's fundamentally what it's trying to get you to. So we have these various ways in which we can help set up the conditions for this deeper turning about. And we can also help to bring about this turning about on a deep level by opening ourselves to the qualities of awakening. Another way of putting this is that we can tune in to deeper resources, that our mind has deep resources that we can tap into. It does seem as if there are positive dynamic forces within mind to which we can open ourselves or which we can align ourselves with. And usually when we start our Dharma life, we start with going for refuge, seeing that in terms of us making the effort to take ourselves to enlightenment. And there's nowhere else to start, really. And that's fine. But we can also open ourselves. We can also think in terms of opening ourselves to deeper forces of mind, forces of love and compassion and wisdom and energy and so on. So, as our practice deepens over time, that aspect is likely to come more to the fore. Yeah. We're likely to have less sense that, you know, we just have to do it, you know, pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps to enlightenment. It's more as if we're also connecting with something which feels as if it's coming from beyond us. Yeah. And that's sort of drawing us on. So we can think of going for refuge as both committing ourselves and entrusting ourselves to the three jewels. So it's a bit like a chick in an egg. There we are, kind of pecking away, trying to break out. But it's as if there is something that is trying to break in from outside, from a deeper level, that is also, as it were, trying to liberate us. So we need... We can have both. We have both that making our effort from the everyday level, but also doing our best to tune in to those deeper levels of mind. So this gives us further ways in which we can set up the conditions for this turning about to occur. Firstly, we can acknowledge that there are deeper resources in mind that we can draw on. We can open ourselves to their beneficial influence, which is one way of translating adhisthana. And we can do this through practices like imagining the Buddha, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, through devotion, and so on. Just doing whatever we can to open ourselves to the qualities of awakening that it's often easiest to get to through seeing them embodied or imagining them embodied in a person like us. And if that feels like, well, I don't know, is that a bit Christian? I'm not quite sure. Aren't I back in that sort of world? In a way, I wouldn't worry too much. When Bhante somewhere says, if you feel like praying to a Buddha or Bodhisattva, well, just do it and worry about the metaphysical implications later. You know? It's like you're just trying to open to those deeper qualities. And we start off by getting in touch with these qualities as if they were out there. It feels like, you know, the Buddha is out there, Tara is out there, you know, Manjushri is out there. But the more deeply we enter into relationship with those qualities, we start to recognize that actually they are qualities of mind. We start to become, as it were, more identified with them. More and more. And then eventually there's no me being identified with them. There's just the qualities expressing themselves naturally with no identification. And at that point we've really not just received the positive influence, we are the positive influence, or there just is positive influence. So our own efforts have taken us so far, but then it's as if we also need to tune into something which feels like it's nothing to do with everyday us. So I'd like to finish by going back to the Pacific and back to these wayfinders. And one particular wayfinder, I think his name is something like Nenoa. And he's a modern wayfinder. In 1999, he was the wayfinder, the navigator, on a modern Polynesian boat, which used to make voyages between different islands on the Pacific, called the Hakulea. And this voyage was going to go from Hawaii to Rapa Nui, to Easter Island, which is a distance of over 6,000 miles. It's about 10,000 kilometres. But it involves firstly going across the doldrums, that sort of area of complete sort of low pressure, sort of near the equator, so there's hardly any wind to use. And then going for about 1,400 miles against the prevailing wind. So having to keep tacking and tacking and tacking and tacking and tacking. So the actual distance that the journey took was more like 12,000 miles, more like 20,000 kilometres. To find an island 14 miles wide. So less than 1 degree on a compass, had the Hakulea had a compass, which it didn't. So they set out from Hawaii, weeks and weeks passed, through the doldrums, tacking against the prevailing winds, down into the vicinity of Easter Island. And this wayfinder, Nenoa, staying awake up to 22 hours a day, tracking up to 5 different ocean currents and the winds, different stars coming over the horizon, took them all that way, took the crew and the passengers almost to Easter Island. And then, at a certain point, he snapped awake out of a sleep to a sea fog completely overcast, And he realized that he didn't know where they were. He'd lost track of where they were. And there's nothing much in the sea around Easter Island. If you miss Easter Island, well, good luck. So he'd lost that continuity of mind and memory, which was essential to his survival and the survival of all those people who depended on him. So he hid his fear from the crew. But he was in complete despair. Lost. And then, out of that despair, he remembered his teacher, the man who had taught him all the skills of wayfinding over many, many years. And this teacher, this guide to him, called Mao, said to him, "Can you see the image of the island in your mind? Can you see the image of the island in your mind?" And at that point, Nainoa became calm. And he realized that in a way he'd already found the island. The Hakulea, the boat he was on, was the island. He had everything he needed on board what they regard as a sacred canoe. And at that moment, the sky brightened. And a beam of warm light shone on his shoulders. And it shone in a particular direction. And the clouds began to clear. And he followed that beam of light directly to the island, directly to Easter Island. So after a journey equivalent to 20,000 kilometres, he'd found his island, 23 kilometres, 14 miles wide. But what had happened was that after week of wakefulness and acute observation and calculation, he came to the end of his mental resources. He came to the end of the resources of his everyday self, however extraordinary those were. All that work from an egoic level only took him so far. To find his goal, he had to be lost. And then to entrust himself to a vision, to deeper forces of mind. And when he did that, he found that he was always at home. And he was led by the golden light until the tiny island rose up out of the water to meet, embrace and welcome him. And he delivered his passengers safely onto dry land. Similarly, we set out on a voyage of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. We commit ourselves to the journey, prepared, as Whitman says, to risk the ship, ourselves and all, recognizing that if we stay where we are, we shall never be free. We shall be stuck in the world of suffering. So we hold in mind a vision of the island of freedom, of true security. And as part of the journey, we reflect on the nature of things, and we also try to see our experience directly, beyond the veil of assumptions and concepts. And we don't travel alone. We open our hearts to others, thinking in terms of all of us rather than just me. And we're prepared to steer for the deep waters only, which means becoming aware of and positively affecting deep levels of mind. But steering for the deep waters also means seeing our going for refuge not just as commitment, but also as entrusting ourselves to deeper forces, opening to the positive influence of the awakened ones, including our teachers, just as Nainoa, in his time of great need, remembered his teacher's words. Can you see the image of the island in your mind? When we open ourselves to positive influences in this way, we can be sure that the golden light of the Dharma will shine, and that we shall be guided to our true home, which isn't anywhere else. It's just the true understanding, the profound relaxation into the depth dimension of this present moment.